You are listening to the
Tricorder
Transmissions Special.
Episode 26.
And
now,
here are
Craig
and
Jeff.
Welcome back to the Tricorder Transmissions, everybody. This is the second part of our Season 3 wrap-up episode, as always. We're your hosts, Jeff Hewlett.
And Craig Cohen.
Back in the third chair seat for the second week in a row is Mr. Chris Ritzer. How's it going, Chris?
Going all right.
Just all right?
Yeah, doing good.
All right. Good. So last week, we did the first half of Season 3. Starting out with Spock's brain and finishing up with the empath. So if you haven't listened to that part, please rewind, go out and grab a copy of that and catch up with us, because we're going to start off with Elon of Troyes this time around. And I believe Craig Cohen's going to kick us off with the first synopsis.
Yes, from TV Guide, December 14th, 1968. Kirk must tame a shrew when he undertakes a stormy mission of peace, taking the high priestess of a warrior people to marry her enemy's ruler. Alan, a most unwilling bride, is the hauteur of a Chinese empress and the manners of Henry VIII.
So we have a split essential vote on this episode. Craig went essential. He stated his argument might be weak before he gave his reasoning. The reasoning was character moments for Kirk, establishing that the Enterprise is his first love. It's a characteristic that defines who he is, in Craig's opinion. The love for the Enterprise is so strong, it can overcome the power of Elan's tears and break the spell that was considered unbreakable and uncurable. So I went non-essential for my standard reasons. No new aliens that recur. No new recurring characters. There are some good character moments for some Trek regulars on the Enterprise, but nothing that that stood out to me to make it essential. So, Craig, do you want to expand a little bit on your essential vote?
Yeah, a little bit. I think also, based on the discussions that we had during our commentary, and then even afterwards on the Facebook group and on Twitter, about whether or not what Alan was feeling was genuine or not, makes this an even more essential discussion, at least.
Oh.
And I think if you're able to discuss an episode this much, it really almost makes it lean towards essential, because obviously there's something going on there that has people responding to it in such different ways.
Well, that's an interesting way to think about it. Chris Ritzer, do you have a counter argument or a pro argument?
I'm going non-essential on this one. I think the best argument you can make for it to be essential would be that the Enterprise is Kirk's first love. And it is a good episode. I think it's fun, but non-essential. Just not enough there.
But I mean, but ultimately, how many great Kirk character moments do we get over the course of the series? I almost feel like there's so many other characters that get developed. And yeah, Kirk has some real watershed moments, you know, Your City's on the Edge of Forever, episodes like that, Space Heat, iconic episodes. But I don't know, I feel like this episode, you know, the fact that Kirk broke the spell, a chemical reaction that no man is supposed to be able to withstand, I don't know, for me, that kind of speaks volumes about Kirk and his duty to his ship and his love of his ship.
It's a good argument.
Yeah, I think that's also a good reason to vote it non-essential, too, though.
You think it reveals too much?
No, I just think it's kind of a lame way to end the show. It's just, okay, it's like, there's no cure, so well, let's just pull something out of a hat, pretty much. And I mean, it's a clever way to do it and all, but it's essential. No, I don't think so. It's close, but not quite.
Yeah, fair enough. I don't think I'm gonna change my vote at this point. You know, I definitely think Craig's argument has some merit, because I do like seeing those examples of Kirk's extreme love for the Enterprise itself, and how you can really make a case for the Enterprise being his lady, as it were. But I mean, we've seen it in other episodes before. You know, we've heard about the love for the ship, and we see it again. I don't think I'm going to change my vote. So we have some commentary again from Matt Walski, one of our most talkative listeners on Facebook. Thank you again, Matt, for sending all this stuff in. So Matt also feels that Ilana Troyce is non-essential. He said, down to preference or nostalgia, but he finds it a decent episode. Essentially, Kirk taming the shrew, Ilan's extremely bitchy woman who comes to good in the end. Appearance of a Klingon battlecruiser. The first appearance of the Klingon battlecruiser, he says, in the production order. Which, I don't remember it actually being the first appearance of that ship, but interesting. What do you think, Chris? Do you have any insight into that?
He might be right.
Yeah, we might have been thrown off because we watched the special editions.
Or the
remastered editions.
Yeah, that might be right. Yeah.
Yes, in season three, that'd be the second episode of the season, if you're going production order. And then I think the same ship, does it pop up in the episode with Kang? You don't have to bust out the old editions and check it out.
Yeah, we did. That's a good point, Craig. We did watch the special edition. So all the old episodes from the first couple of seasons that had Klingons in them had that same ship model. So maybe that's what threw us off.
Mm-hmm.
But good on you there, Matt. Thanks for throwing that in. So, all right. So that wraps up Ilana Troyce, I think. So we can move on to the next episode. And that would be Whom Gods Destroy. And I remember very fondly talking about how I always have trouble with the title of this episode, because I always want to insert a "the" in there.
Yes.
Whom the Gods Destroy. But it's not Whom the Gods Destroy, it's Whom Gods Destroy. So Craig Cohen, you're up.
The NBC press release issued December 5th, 1968 reads, Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock become prisoners in an intergalaxy asylum where the inmates have seized control and plan to rule the universe in Whom Gods Destroy on NBC Television Network Star Trek Color Cast of Friday, January 3rd.
So this episode is a double essential episode. So Craig and I both gave it the thumbs up, and there are quite a few reasons here. Let's see, we'll start off with the double nerve pinch. So we got Spock doing a double-handed nerve pinch, two people at once. Pretty cool. Introduced the historic Starfleet figure Garth, and we find out that Kirk had studied Garth's exploits in Starfleet Academy. So we get a little bit of Starfleet Academy backstory there, and Garth's history in Starfleet, letting us know that it's been around a lot longer than the Kirk era. So we can get some history there and how far back Starfleet goes. And the Vulcan, a little bit of Vulcan culture, when Spock talks a little bit about Vulcan nursery school, he makes a reference to Vulcan nursery school. So any extended thoughts on this, Craig?
This is another one of those episodes where a year from now, if you ask me what season this episode was in, I'm not 100% sure I'd be able to say it was season three. And I think that speaks maybe to the quality of this episode. From just a storytelling perspective, the way it was executed, and also the performances, especially the one that we talked about on our commentary from Yvonne Craig.
Yes, excellent, excellent, excellent points. Chris Ritzer, any thoughts on Garth of Izar or any of the other firsts we see in this episode?
Yeah, I wasn't really... I mean, Garth is a cool character and all that, but that really doesn't make it essential for me. This is non-essential, I think. Because, I mean, you've never heard of this guy before, and they don't bring him up at all afterwards. So, I mean, if you've never heard about him before, I mean, how big is guy, really? I mean, I think you just pulled him out of a hat, sort of. And, I mean, it's a good episode. It's worth watching, but not essential.
Understood. So, you know, I think the reasoning behind using Garth as an essential piece of the episode was more about using him as a piece of Starfleet history, necessarily. For me, anyway, I like knowing that this was a guy who was one of the greatest Starfleet captains. He was used as a template moving forward for other captains to model themselves after. I thought it was fascinating that he was a guy that was studied, kind of like we study, you know, great warlords and generals and things today in our history classes. This was something that Kirk was studying and also modeled himself after as a Starfleet captain. So I thought that was kind of a cool reference.
Oh, totally.
All right. Matt Walsky has quite a bit of information here. He does consider this non-essential, though. He says he loves the show mainly because of Garth. He likes the fact that you had the you had Garth imitating Shatner, so you had Shatner playing another version of Kirk briefly in this episode, which is always fun. He likes the way he can alter his body. It was an interesting power, knowing that it wasn't an innate power. It was something that he learned how to do after the fact. Pretty interesting. So he likes the lunatics taking over the asylum better than the execution and Dagger of the Mind. Does have its problems, though, namely where Spock is having issues working out which Kirk is which. So Matt has a little bit of trouble with that part. He likes the fight between the two Kirks. And it's hard to see Shatner's stunt double, hard to tell the double from Shatner. So a couple of notes about Yvonne Craig being fun to watch. He loves the double neck pinch. He pointed that out, too. Good to see Andorians and Tellarites again. We don't get enough Andorians and Tellarites in the original series. I don't think so, anyway. And he likes the security challenge password implementation on the Enterprise where, you know, the... What was it? Queen to Queen's level 4 or something? Queen to Queen's level... What was it? Yeah, I think that was it. So that's something I think we talked about in the episode, Craig, was that that seemed to be such a good idea, and they didn't universally use that.
Yeah.
You know, as a way to signal the ship that there was trouble without giving yourself away, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and how many times would that have come in handy over the years?
Oh, yeah. Great comments there, and they make me want to go back and watch this episode, like, immediately.
Yeah, this is one of my third season favorites by a long shot. So one of a small handful that I think you know warrants a lot of repeat watches just because of the quality. So any final thoughts from Chris or Craig on this before we move on?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. No, except we have a great 1-2 punch.
So next episode in the running order is Let That Be Your Last Battlefield.
Yes, and that was the 1-2 punch I was referring to.
Yes.
Just tremendous. The NBC press release issued December 20th, 1968. Frank Gorshin is guest star as Belli, one of two aliens who threaten to explode the Enterprise in their battle with each other, climaxing 50,000 years of hatred in Let That Be Your Last Battlefield on the NBC television network's Star Trek Colorcast Friday, January 10th.
Another double essential episode, as you alluded to prior, Craig, at the 1-2 punch. You know, this is interesting essential reasons on this episode. Craig and I both had similar reasons. Craig, you specifically pointed out the presentation of the process and means to destroy the Enterprise. So that's the self-destruct sequence that we actually see reused verbatim in Star Trek III when the Vulcans are about... not the Vulcans, the Klingons are about to board the... partially destructed Enterprise over the Genesis planet. So Spock giving some Vulcan history about logic, saving their society and essentially saving the Vulcan race, and some insight into McCoy's ability to work on alien beings that he's not familiar with and have medical success. So you have some insight into McCoy's skill into working on non-humans. So Craig, any expansion on your essential votes?
No, not at all. I just this is another one of those episodes that even before we started this series, if I was going to list my top five favorite episodes, this would have been in it. I'm not sure this is the top five anymore after our series, but it's definitely still a top 10 for me.
Hmm. Chris, what's your thoughts on Let That Be Your Last Battlefield?
It is a good episode. I'll go essential on this one. I think there's probably two episodes in the entire run that you can truly, I think, classify as cocktail party episodes. I think this is one of them, along with Trouble with Tribbles. Because yeah, this one this was pretty popular with the common person out there, and well, definitely one of the more well-known episodes, especially for the topics it brought up. Mm-hmm. So yeah, overall, yeah, it's a pretty good episode, and yeah, essential on this one.
Yeah, definitely agree. This episode is very famous for its pretty in your face racial tension motif, and you know, this is one of the things that Star Trek is famous for, and one of the reasons why I think it endures as well as it does, at least the original series, because it tackled these types of topics. So one of the things I think Craig and I kind of goofed on, though, near the end of this episode is when they're running through the hallways.
Yes.
And the running is just so ham-fisted. It's so it's very unconvincing. And after the intensity of the episode leading up to that point, I thought that was kind of a little bit of a letdown near the end. But Matt Walsky calls this episode essential as well. It's not subtle, but it's brilliantly written and handled very well. Frank Gorshin is intense, as always, and good to watch. Has good scenes with Lokai and Kirk. The self-destruct sequence is introduced. He calls that out. And is reused word for word in Star Trek III, as we said before. So guarantees his essential status in Matt's mind. So everybody's got an essential across the board for Let That Be Your Last Battlefield. So seeing as it's a four-way essential vote here, if anybody out there who's listening to this wants to comment on Facebook about why they think this is a non-essential episode, we'd love to hear about it. So I always want to hear some differing opinions on some of these. So, and either of you guys have closing comments before we move on?
Yeah, for some reason that at the end when they're running through the halls, that gave me flashbacks to the alternative factor for some reason. There's something about it. I'm like, ugh.
You know why? It's because they have the overlay of, you know, the burning, you know, war zones.
That's
and when the two in the alternative factor during those fight scenes, they had that same kind of flashing effect, right, with the weird gels in the background.
Yeah.
So it kind of looked very similar with the superimposition.
Chris, I'm glad that doesn't ruin your enjoyment or appreciation of Let That Be Your Last Battlefield.
That would
be really tragic if that episode was unwatchable for you because of that connection.
Oh, that's funny. All right. So moving along, next episode in the running order is The Mark of Gideon, Craig Cohen.
All right. From the NBC press release issued December 27th, 1968, alien beauty seeks to use Captain Kirk to bring death to millions of people. Captain Kirk finds himself alone aboard the Enterprise with a mysterious and beautiful alien, guest star Sharon Acker, who seeks to use his blood to cause millions of deaths, including her own, on NBC television network Star Trek, Friday, January 17th.
Pretty heavy subject matter in this one, but double non-essential from Craig and I. So pretty much same reasons as we do a lot of the other non-essentials. No recurring new alien races, no memorable character moments, no new technology, nothing really that would draw somebody in to learn something about the Star Trek universe really by watching this episode. Although the social commentary of this episode is really interesting if you read between the lines and look underneath the surface. But one great thing I really love about this episode, though, is you get to see so much empty Enterprise. So empty bridges, empty hallways, empty rooms with just Kirk or maybe Kirk and the girl. So a lot of fun to watch. Just for that reason, it's interesting to take a look at this episode.
Yeah, and this is one of those episodes that I really at least appreciated for, I think at the time I called it the spooky factor, especially in the early setup of the episode. I really think that was an avenue that Star Trek should have done more, you know, in the vein of like a cat's paw. Just your episodes that you could watch on Halloween and feel like it was appropriate.
That's a good point. Chris, what do you think about this episode?
Non-essential, but it's a really good episode, I think. It's not enough to make it essential. And I like the story. It's definitely different, and it's very Star Trek, I guess. It's a cool episode to watch, but Yeah, you can definitely, you're not missing anything if you don't see it.
Good points. So Matt Walsky also considers this a non-essential, and he actually calls out something that we were talking about on the commentary that I think bears mentioning again, since Chris Ritzer is on. I'd love to hear his take on this. So in this episode, if you remember, the Gideon people created a scale replica of the Enterprise in which they placed Captain Kirk. But the whole concept is the planet is so overpopulated, there's not even enough space for people to sit down. So where the hell did they build it? Thanks for bringing this point back up, Matt. I almost forgot about this. So how did they build it, but where was it on the planet? Because there are people actually pressed up against the outside of it. You know, Kirk looks out the window and sees the faces out there, right? So the people are right up against the outside of the ship. So where the hell is it?
Yeah, I was thinking that exact same thing before you even said that. I'm like, how the hell did they actually build this thing? And I guess maybe they were just like crowd surfing going on or something like that. Or must have like push everyone up and everything. And I don't know. It's impressive, but who knows?
You know, I was thinking maybe since they had so many people, it's like one of those extreme home makeover shows where they just bring in 75 people to reno one house. That's why they can do it in 2 days, right? What would normally take a regular crew, you know, 6 weeks, 7 weeks, 8 weeks, 10 weeks to do, they can do it in 5 minutes because they have 80 million people working on it. Everybody hammers one nail, we're done in 10 minutes. But all right, so non-essentials all around for the Mark of Gideon. So let's move on to the next episode, That Which Survives. And we had a special guest on this episode in our intro. And that would be Mr. Mark Cushman, one of our favorite guests who wrote These Are the Voyages, Volumes 1, 2, and 3 that we talk about so much. So if you're interested in hearing Mark talk about his writing, you know, take a look at the That Which Survives commentary episode. So Craig Cohen, what's the synopsis for this one?
And speaking of the Mark Cushman books, These Are the Voyages, that's where we actually get our press releases or our TV guide entries from. So it's a great resource for that alone.
Absolutely.
Among many others. From the press release issued November 11th, 1968, Captain Kirk and Dr. McCoy face death on a hostile planet without food and water as the Enterprise is hurled 1,000 light years away from them in That Which Survives on NBC Television Network's Star Trek, Friday, December 13th.
So this is one of the rarer split essential vote episodes where Craig votes essential and I vote non-essential. So Craig's essential reasoning was that they had some good technology moments and some new ways to use the tricorder technology. My non-essential was, it's actually an honorable mention because we see a woman at the helm of the Enterprise for the first time in the Sulu position. So that's pretty cool. But still a non-essential episode for me. No recurring new aliens, things of that nature. So Craig, any expanding thoughts on your essential vote?
No, I think I made a pretty good case for it. And it seems like deep in your heart, with the honorable mention, you wanted to try and find a way to make it essential. But it's understandable. You know, you have a strict code that you operate by.
That's true. That's true. I do. And as for your strict code, Chris Risser, what does it say for this episode?
Non-essential once again. I think it's an all right episode, but yeah, nothing really important happens in it. It's all right. It's just sort of like the entire third season, just about. There's a lot of all right stuff in there, but yeah, non-essential.
So Matt Walsky also considers this non-essential. Nothing outstanding, but enjoyable. Some Sulu in the landing party. Oh, interesting thing. I don't know if we mentioned this in the commentary, Craig. You might have mentioned this, but Tackleberry from Police Academy, Tackleberry's father-in-law plays the doomed blue shirt guy that dies on the planet.
Okay, yeah.
So if everybody's a Police Academy fan out there, I know I liked at least the first one. Scotty saving the ship is very good. Spock has some funny lines throughout the episode. So that brings us to a close in this episode, unless you guys have anything else to say about it.
Nope. No, I don't think so.
All right. Moving right along, next up is Lights of Zetar.
All right. And from the NBC press release issued January 9th, 1968, alien entities endanger the Enterprise when they take over the brain of a beautiful lieutenant aboard the ship in the lights of Zetar on NBC television network Star Trek, Friday, January 31st.
Mm, yeah, this is the Scotty drives everyone ballistic episode. Yeah, this is a rough one. So double non-essential from us on this episode. You know, nothing new presented here. No aliens, no new tech, no great character moments. In fact, I think Craig and I both agreed during the commentary that this episode is almost damaging to Scotty's character in some ways. And you may be better off actually not seeing Scotty in this capacity, knowing the heroics that he's responsible for and how highly regarded he is. So I think in this episode and Who Mourns for Adonis, you get to see that really annoying Scotty in love kind of thing. So either of you guys have any thoughts on Scotty in love?
Something that should be avoided at all costs whenever they were writing an episode. And they did not learn the first time. I'm very disappointed.
Craig?
Yeah, non-essential, by the way.
Oh, great. I was going to ask you that afterwards. Craig, thoughts on Scotty in love?
I like the attempt. It's just the execution is just so
bad.
So bad that it really turned you off of the idea completely. But I really think that was a good avenue to go down with Scotty. And it's a shame that we never really got that definitive Scotty love moment in the series.
Mm. Yeah. Good point. Matt Walsky considers this non-essential as well. One of the most boring shows in the series. Scotty in love is incredibly annoying. He points it out too. He thought it was bearable in Who Mourns for Adonis, but in this episode it's grating. So I actually kind of felt it was kind of grating in both, but I can see his point. It was a little more subdued, I guess, in Who Mourns for Adonis. So actually he brings up something that we talked about on the commentary track, and I think it bears re-mentioning here, is this episode introduces Memory Alpha, which has become the online Star Trek compendium for knowledge. So very interesting that addition was there. I mean, not that it would make the episode essential, because it's really a website now where you can go online and look up all kinds of great Star Trek information. But it's nice to know where the name of that website came from.
Yes.
And I think, Matt also points out something that's interesting too. And this is a continuity problem that, you know, we know the original series has a lot of continuity problems. But one thing he says that Scotty says at one point in the episode that he and Mira will have, or Myra will have all the time in the world, but then you never see her again. So it's interesting. You'd think that this would be Scotty's maybe recurring girlfriend, but
happen. I don't know if that's a fair. Well, it's a fair criticism of Star Trek, but I think that's a problem with the series overall.
Sure.
Yeah, it's just the reset button, pretty much from week to week, and
I mean, if you look at the beast. Yeah, if you look at what they did with Uhura when she had her memory wiped, or what was it, the one crew member whose husband got murdered.
Yep.
And then the next week she was, you know, off having fun on shore leave.
Yeah, with a different, completely different guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is more. It was an episodic show, not a serial show. So it wasn't. There was no continuity from episode to episode. There are very few instances where episodes made reference to other episodes. So, at any rate, ready to close up on this one and move on, gentlemen?
Oh, yeah.
All right. Next up is Requiem for Methuselah, Mr. Cohen.
All right. And we have from the NBC press release issued January 24th, 1969, a raging plague aboard the Enterprise sends Captain Kirk, Mr. Spock, and Dr. McCoy to a planet inhabited by Methuselah, who wishes the ship to remain in suspension for 2,000 years on NBC television network Star Trek, Friday, February 14th. A Valentine's Day episode.
Ah, how appropriate. We give it a double non-essential.
Well, it is red.
It is. It is double non-essential. Not much to say about that. I mean, pretty much the typical non-essential arguments from us. You know, nothing new on display here, nothing to take forward into the future of Trek, nothing we can look back on and remember as being introduced in this episode. So, Chris, do you have any particular thoughts on this episode that may sway us?
I don't have many thoughts on this episode because I can barely even remember it. So I guess since I can't remember it, probably wasn't that good. So I'll go non-essential.
Yeah, you know, speaking of, this is a very forgettable episode, I think. And even the synopsis that Craig read, it doesn't necessarily elicit memories of this episode. But when I think about the Kirk love interest in this episode, this is another one of those episodes where a guy tries to build the perfect woman, right? And it backfires on him. So we saw that, you know, earlier in the series. And in this one, it's Raina, the Wonder Robot, that Kirk somehow inexplicably falls so deeply in love with after talking to her for 3 minutes that, you know, he's willing to... Isn't this the episode where Kirk tells Spock to butt out because they're fighting over a woman?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and I think we even talked about how we thought this was a little bit damaging for Kirk as well.
Yes, uh-huh.
Because it seems so out of character. I mean, he's fallen in love before, quote unquote, but in this one, it just seemed a little bit over the top. Craig, mm-hmm. what do you think?
No, I agree. And, you know, it's so funny that we talked at the, you know, earlier parts of this episode about Alon of Troyes and Kirk's ability to sort of keep things in check. and then you almost have this full reversal here.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. That's a great point. And, you know, we've seen Kirk in even deeper struggles with his loves when he realizes he has to let Edith Keeler die and he doesn't react, you know, this viscerally to that. He actually gets a little more emotional over it instead of resorting to, you know, fighting over it. Chris, what do you think?
I think Scotty's rubbing off on him a little bit.
Oh, good point. let's see. Matt Walski. Wow, he's got a wall of text on this one. Non-essential. Good and bad parts. Kirk shouldn't really fall in love that quickly and forget about his crew's plight. That's something else that we forgot to talk about. Not only was it out of character for Kirk to fall so in love, but the crew up on the Enterprise had a ticking time bomb. They had a disease, wasn't it, they were suffering from? And they were trying to get this Rytalin or whatever it was, the cure from the planet to save them. And Kirk's, you know, for the sake of this woman he just met, he's putting the entire crew in danger. I think that could have been one of those moments where Spock and McCoy could have thrown some regulations at him to take the captain's seat away from him.
Yeah, this is how he was acting when he was going undercover to get the cloaking device from the Romulans, except mm-hmm. this is just normal form in this episode. Yeah, it's just really bad writing in this episode.
Yeah, and it's so bad that, you know, Matt also is reminding us of the scene at the end where Spock erases the memory out of Kirk's mind so that he can forget Raina down on the planet after only being down there for, what, a half an hour? And he's so in love that his head's down on his desk and Spock goes in there. I mean, it, you know, as a character moment, Spock having that much of an affection for Kirk to want to remove that pain from him is brilliant. I like that a lot, but it just doesn't play out as well as it could have.
And I think that this is overall really the loss or feeling the loss of Gene L. Coon and his influence on the show and having somebody who really understood the show and its characters, and not to take anything away from Fred Freiberger, who was working, you know, who was doing his job, but possibly didn't understand the show as well as some other, you know, as well as Gene L. Coon did.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yeah, I didn't even think about it that way.
So Matt finishes up by pointing out that there was a non-canon novelization that brought back the Flint character. And I think he said it was called Cry of the Onlys. And during that novelization, Kirk's memories were triggered and Spock had to explain what had happened during that time. So if you're a Trek book reader, Chris, have you read that one?
No, I have not.
So I know Chris has read a lot of the books. So if you're interested in a follow-up to that, you can check out that book, Cry of the Onlys, and read a little bit more about Mr. Flint and Kirk and Spock having an encounter again in the future. So are we ready to move on to Space Hippies, gentlemen?
Well, I just want to say, it would have been nice if Spock's Vulcan mind trick would have worked on the audience and erased all of our memories of this episode.
Oh, man. So at the end of the episode, Nimoy walks up to the camera and puts his hand on the lens.
Yes.
And it's the equivalent of the Men in Black neuralizer, right? Did I just watch Star Trek? Where'd that hour go? All right. So on to a very, very, very popular Trek episode, noted as the worst Trek episode by many people, The Way to Eden. Craig Cohen, you're up.
All right. And from the NBC press release issue January 31st, 1969, rebels capture the Enterprise and threaten its destruction unless they are taken to the planet Eden in The Way to Eden on NBC television network Star Trek, Friday, February 21st.
I would love to know the reactions to people who are listening to this who know that this was a double essential episode, and you wouldn't expect it to be a double essential episode. I'm sure Chris will have some arguments to that. Craig, you cited the cocktail party rule, which you can expand on in a moment, and I actually gave this episode an essential because if you ever listen to Walter Koenig talk about his time on the original series, one of his biggest regrets is they never really fleshed out the Chekhov character. And this episode is one of the only episodes where you get to learn anything about Chekhov's backstory, his real backstory. I mean, we know he's Russian. But in this episode, you learn about a girl that he dated who reoccurs in this episode. You learn his middle name, and he talks about some of his time at the Academy. So it's pretty cool that, a major recurring character who's a part of the second two seasons and all of the movies gets some fleshing out in this episode. So I thought that alone, if you're looking for as much information about the characters on the show from watching the show, this is an episode you would have to watch to understand a little bit more about Chekhov, or the only things you could really learn about Chekhov. So Craig, you want to talk a little bit more about your cocktail party rule?
Yeah, and I think, the cocktail party rule in essence is just the fact that being aware of a Star Trek episode that you are pretty sure people would be talking about at a hypothetical cocktail party where people are going to be talking about Star Trek. But I think, and we also got into this with some of the other worst of episodes like Spock's Brain, in the sense that in order to be considered the worst episode, we both talked about the importance of boredom more than anything else, where as long as the episode entertains, it can't really be considered the worst of the series. And I think much like Spock's Brain, The Way to Eden falls under that category. By no means is it a boring episode. No, by no means is it a chore to sit through. So using that criteria, it would be really hard for me to discourage somebody from sitting down to watch it and form their own opinion.
Yeah, excellent, excellent points. And that's a really great explanation of the cocktail party rule. So thanks for expanding on that. I know you've used it several times throughout these seasons of the show. So nice to have a reiteration of what you mean when you employ that rule. So Chris Ritzer, now is your opportunity to tell us why this episode is non-essential.
Oh, no, it's essential.
Oh!
Of course.
Shocker.
I was actually wrong earlier. Yeah, there's actually three cocktail party episodes, and this is the third one. Even the parts that are no good, it's so bad that it's good. Like, when that guy is singing, that's just cringeworthy, but it's so bad that you laugh at it, and it's like, you go with it. The Chekhov stuff, yeah, it's really nice to see Walter finally get some a little bit more screen time. Get his backstory, that was cool. It's nice to see Spock jamming out a little bit and getting all hippie and showing his musical side. And it's not a bad episode. I don't know why it gets that rap. I mean, it's entertaining. There's nothing that really makes you. It's not like it wasn't Methuselah. That was just. I mean, now that's a bad episode. This one, no. This one is, it's very enjoyable, and it's one of the few endings that's not a happy ending for Star Trek. Usually it's always happy, and not this one.
Yeah.
Great point.
Yeah, great point. Great point. Very depressing ending, actually. So
yes,
Matt Walski is going to disagree with the three of us and call this non-essential. It's hard, it's in the right place, and admittedly the songs are catchy, but this is a notorious episode for obvious reasons. Spock jamming with the hippies, one of whom seems to be playing a bicycle wheel. Yeah, we picked on that. It's a cocktail party moment, but perhaps for the wrong reasons. Chekhov gets a lot to do, which is nice. Never gets boring, and it's better than Gideon and Zitar, but it's one you you try to watch alone so you don't die from embarrassment in front of other people. I think, if I recall correctly, this was James Doohan's least favorite original series episode. He had a lot of problems with this one.
I think in general, James Doohan probably had a problem with hippies.
Yeah, he may be. That may be true. So I quite enjoyed this. And, you know, one thing I loved about the commentary to this episode, Craig, is that we kind of explored the reused Journey to Eden plot from Star Trek V and wondered if the two Edens were actually one in the same place. Yeah. But they actually wound up, we did a little bit of sleuthing during the commentary, and it turns out that they were not, because Spock admits at the end that it was not actually the right location. So
yeah.
So fascinating stuff. So either of you guys have any closing remarks on the way to Eden?
Severin.
Yes.
The leader of the hippie group.
Yep.
If I remember correctly, you guys were talking during your commentary about his ears or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I was always under the impression he's not human.
Right.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, yeah. All right.
Yeah, I think there was a debate or a split between me and Jeff on whether it was natural or if it was some kind of 23rd century body modification.
Yeah, if that's a body modification, that's really impressive. And like modern people who get like their ears stretched out for piercings and all that would be like, whoa, yes, it advanced to that stage. But no, I think this dude was a alien.
Okay. Fair enough. Fair enough. I just didn't know if they were some kind of prosthetics that he was wearing for some purpose or some sort of maybe jewelry or decoration, or I don't know. But I can buy that he was not human. Anybody out there has any other insights? And maybe he shows up in books somewhere that I'm not aware of, but let me get a little more information on Dr. Severin. All right. So are we ready to move on to the next episode, guys?
Let's go.
All right. Next up is the Cloud Minders.
And let's see. Jumping into the NBC press release issued February 4th, 1969. Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock, on an emergency mission to stop a plague, become involved in a rebellion of slaves against their masters in the Cloud Minders on NBC Television Network Star Trek, Friday, February 28th.
Right. So this is a double non-essential, and this was one of the episodes that I really, really enjoy watching, but unfortunately couldn't find any reasons to call it essential. So it was difficult for me to call one of my one episode I'm very fond of non-essential. But according to my own criteria, there was nothing here that I could use to as leverage to make it essential. And Craig, you also voted non-essential in this episode. Deva, any thoughts on why or anything that maybe could have made it essential and didn't quite make the cut?
I don't think so. I think this is just unfortunately one of those episodes, and we ran into quite a few of them over the course of the 79 episodes, where as entertaining, as great as the episode is, there's just nothing there that fits the criteria to make this part of an abbreviated essential viewing run for somebody, you know, just coming to the series.
Yeah. So Chris, any thoughts on Cloud Minders?
I think you guys summed it up pretty good. Non-essential. It's a really good episode. Some good Trek commentary going on and all that, but it's just, it's not essential.
Hmm. Matt Walski does call it an essential episode. Says he loves it. He likes the visuals of the floating city, but he claims that it might have been ripped off from Flash Gordon, but also predating the Bespin City in the Clouds from The Empire Strikes Back. So the City in the Clouds concept itself being used quite a bit in sci-fi. Kirk, Kirk pretty much incites a revolution here of the troglites by introducing the concept of the gas masks to negate the noxious fumes that were causing them to have a stunted evolution, as it were. So this is one of those prime directive questions, whether or not Kirk and crew should have interfered in the natural progression of this culture of this planet. So Matt also points out that David Gerald hated the ending. He thought the solution was too easy, and the Enterprise can just kind of leave without a second thought. But Matt feels he misses the point, so he says that Kirk kind of set a ball in motion, so it had a bigger implication than just being an easy solution. So, and also Spock discussing Pon Farr.
Oh yeah.
Out of character for him, totally. With a complete stranger. And we knew from Amok Time that Pon Farr was a very
private
thing, and Kirk had to pretty much pry it out of him under orders to talk about it, right?
Yeah.
So a little out of character Spock moment. So Chris, what do you think about that out of character Spock moment? Is that another example of poor continuity in the writing, you think?
Yeah, that's something. I guess whoever wrote this episode just didn't do their homework and read the Star Trek Bible and didn't realize what was going on there. It's just one of those problems with Star Trek. From week to week, you really don't know what you're going to get sometimes. Sometimes it'll jive, but more often than not, it won't.
Yeah, excellent. And looking back, I still wish that I could have found a reason to call this essential. I was hoping, reading through Matt's notes here, that he would find something in there that I would be able to use, but unfortunately not. So, Craig, you're not changing your vote, are you?
Nope.
Okay. So I guess that's enough for that one, and we'll move on. Next up is another candidate for the worst Star Trek episode. I've seen this one listed as the worst as well.
What?
And this is the Savage Curtain.
The NBC press release reads, Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock are forced to fight for survival with reincarnations of the most evil representatives from history in the Savage Curtain on NBC Television Network Star Trek Friday, March 7th.
Yeah, and I heard Chris Ritzer crying out when he heard that this was one of the worst episodes. So this is a split essential vote. Craig Cohen says non-essential, and I said essential. So in my mind, the introduction of the Kalis character, father of the Klingon way of life, and Surak, who is essentially the father of the logical Vulcan way of life. They're two significant aliens who recur in other series as well as books. So I felt that those character introductions were enough to make this episode have some historical significance. And I'm sure Chris Ritzer will agree on the Kalis angle.
Yes, sir. Yeah, I think this is definitely an essential episode. Yeah, for Kalis and Surak. With both of them, those are two pretty big figures in Star Trek lore. And plus, Abe Lincoln was totally badass too. So, so yeah, I dig this episode. I think it's a lot of fun, and one of the worst episodes. That just blows my mind. I actually never read that or anything, but I never usually read those lists. But those people, they probably like Voyager or something like that. So,
oh no!
Whatever they think, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, here's that classic Chris Ritzer moments that we love in these episodes.
I think the main thing here that I think I talked about way back when we were doing the episode with Zefram Cochrane is if you take that character out of the original series and don't think about the Next Generation movie that he appeared in, you really wonder how important these historical figures are. Does it really matter to us who invented the warp drive or what Vulcan decided to, you know, break off and, you know, stop feeling.
Okay, I'll turn that argument around on you then.
Okay.
Go back to shore leave. What does it matter that you meet Kirk's bully back in Starfleet Academy? I mean, pretty much that's what the entire thing is based around for a worthwhile episode there.
Yeah, but you could argue, Chris, that character had a lasting impact on Captain Kirk's character and how he developed as a character to get where he was.
Oh, but you have the Klingon pretty much god and the Vulcan like Grand Poobah. I mean, they influence entire races, massive influence on Spock, massive influence on every Klingon you've seen. I mean, that's way more of an influence there.
Yeah, but
I mean, this is a guy that probably influenced Kirk when they went out drinking. I mean, and they got into fights at bars. I mean,
yeah, but shore leave has the cocktail party rule going for it as well.
No, that's not cocktail. That's not that big. I mean, if you go to the average person on the street, they'll be like, "What the hell are you talking about?" I mean, really, the biggest thing that the thing has going for it is a big bunny rabbit, and that's about it.
And, you know, you can say, if you want to throw Zefram Cochrane into this, you can say Zefram Cochrane is the father of the Enterprise. So he's part of the Enterprise's backstory. Without the warp drive, there would be no Star Trek.
Yes, sir, Bobby.
So, interesting. I guess this is an argument we could probably go on for quite a while, throwing these different references out at each other. But Matt Walsky has quite a lot of text here about the Savage Curtain. He feels it's non-essential, but he does point out, you know, Kalis being the most famous Klingon, Surak. He also points out something interesting that I think we talked about briefly on the commentary for this episode, and that is the introduction of the Colonel Green character. While he's not, you know, a major player, and he's not a major recurring character, it is interesting that they injected some famous Earth human history in between, because you often wonder what the dividing line is between real American or real Earth history and Star Trek history, because you kind of have a mix of people who existed in the real world, like Abraham Lincoln, and then you have fictitious characters who existed in the Star Trek history, like Colonel Green. So it would be an interesting conversation to have as to what point in time did Star Trek's history diverge from the real world we're living in today, if we have some shared historic figures, and then it obviously would split somewhere. Was that split 1967?
It had to be prior to the eugenics wars, which were in the 90s.
Yeah, so but they couldn't, when they were writing the original series, they couldn't think of any, they couldn't use any historic figures that occurred between the end of the 1960s while they were actually writing and 1990, because they didn't know they existed. So, you know, where in that span of time does the actual timeline diverge? So obviously we didn't have eugenics wars in 1990s, but was Ronald Reagan president of the United States in the Star Trek timeline in the 80s? I don't know.
I hope not for their sake.
I don't know. So interesting conversation to have, and maybe that's one of the things we can explore further on a supplemental later. Final thoughts on Savage Curtain, you guys?
We'll have to change Craig's essential vote on the series wrap on this one.
Oh,
we'll see. We'll see. I'll give it another watch and see if anything changes.
Oh, I don't know. Is that out of bounds, Craig? Are we saying that essential votes can change again? Because I don't think we're planning on talking about non-essential shows on the series wrap-up. I think we're only going to focus on the essential ones.
I would say that if you have a change of heart or I think that once we put a bow on the series, that's, I think, the last time you can change an essential or non-essential vote.
Fascinating. Okay.
I think that's fair.
So, all right. Are we ready to move on to all our yesterdays?
Yep.
All right. So here we go. Craig Cohen, fire us off.
All right. From the NBC press release issued February 25th, 1969, my grandmother's, my dad's, and my younger brother's birthday. They all were born on February 25th.
Amazing.
None in 1969, though.
Oh, okay.
Captain Kirk, Mr. Spock, and Dr. McCoy are trapped in the past by a machine just hours before a planet on which the machine is located is to explode. In All Our Yesterdays on NBC Television Network's Star Trek, Friday, March 14th.
Aha. So, double non-essential from Craig and I. Cool episode, though. I enjoy the concept of this episode. It's another instance of time travel in the original series, and I'm always a sucker for those time travel episodes. So, Chris Ritzer, any thoughts on why this episode maybe should be essential?
No. yeah, I'd go non-essential as well. It's a cool episode. It's one of the time travel ones I actually enjoy. It's cool seeing Spock go off the deep end a little bit, but Essential, no.
Matt Walsky points out something interesting, and this is something that Craig and I might not have picked up on because we're not the readers of the novels, but maybe, Chris, you have read these. Matt says a couple of novels point out that Zarabeth actually had Spock's baby called Zar, who it comes back to help the Enterprise crew in some capacity. Did you read any of those?
No, I never heard about that one.
Okay, we'll have to ask Matt to expound on that and tell us what novels they are. I'd be interested in hearing. I never realized Spock had a child in any of the books or anything. So
yeah, I've never heard about that. I don't know. They might have taken that out of the novel canon or something. I don't know.
Craig, did you read any of those books?
No.
Okay. All right. So Matt thinks this is an essential episode. He really enjoys the episode itself. The idea of escaping into the past to escape an impending disaster is imaginative. I agree with that. Mr. Atos and his duplicates are fun. He loves the moment when we talked about this too on the show. He loves the moment when he's trying to wrestle Kirk back through the portal and it throws him on the little dolly cart and tries to roll him through the hole in the wall, the portal. Kirk's part of the story is entertaining, but it's really all about Spock descending into a savage, falling for Zarabeth and threatening to kill Dr. McCoy. So, you know, I agree that is one of the cool parts about this, and it introduces an interesting premise as far as time travel. And I think that this is, of course, we talked about this during the commentary, and it was probably because of that, you know, not being prepared, quote unquote, to go back into the past. So they regress to whatever their species were at that particular time period. So if you were to step through the portal into 5,000 years ago, unprepared by Dr. Atos, you would suddenly become a human 5,000 years in the past. So you would be at that stage of human evolution. So any thoughts on that concept? It's a little bit odd, and I don't think we've seen a lot of time travel stories present that type of a view.
Yeah, for me, I think I even mentioned this on the commentary, is this was one of those episodes that I think if they had done a couple more passes on the script, they might have gotten something that was classic as well as essential. And I really like the concept of having to be prepared to go back in time, even though they don't really explain the hows or the whys. But I kind of like the idea of either being inoculated against or being inoculated to prevent bringing diseases that don't yet exist back to the past. I mean, there was so much potential within that concept. And that concept alone is really, really intriguing. And it's a shame it was tied to such a non-essential episode.
Yeah, I agree. Chris, any thoughts?
Yeah, pretty much what Greg said. Yeah, it's the concept is really, really cool, but that's not what we're really talking about when it comes to essential stuff. So,
all right. So I guess we will move on to the final episode of Star Trek, the original series, and that is Turnabout Intruder.
And jumping once again to the NBC press release issued February 26th, 1969, a scorned woman wreaks a strange vengeance on Captain Kirk when she manages an exchange of bodies with him and takes command of the Enterprise in Turnabout Intruder on NBC Television Network's Star Trek Colorcast of Friday, March 28th.
Excellent. So this is an interesting essential vote in that I am a huge fan of this episode, and I've said that on our commentary, and I've said it other times as well and in some of our discussions with other guests, and I was prepared to vote non-essential on this, and Craig's reasoning swayed me and pushed it over the edge and made it an essential episode for me. So Craig's reasoning, which I found quite compelling, was that Sulu in this episode gets a very brief bit of character building, and that's another rarity. So kind of like the Chekhov character building that we got a few episodes back in The Way to Eden, you get a very brief glimpse into Sulu and who he is and what he stands for. And I think for a character and that doesn't get a lot of expansion through the series, to get that little bit of a glimpse to give us a little flavor of who Sulu is and what he stands for is meaningful. And of course, the Captain Kirk has a little bit more backstory, and another scorned lover from the past comes back to avenge herself on him. So just a little more Kirk backstory. So double essential. Chris, what are your thoughts on the essential nature of Turnabout Intruder?
Non-essential. I enjoy the Kirk moments. Shatner got to stretch a little bit with this one. I honestly can't even remember the Sulu stuff, which is kind of a shame. I have to go back and watch it again, I suppose. But I think a lot of my non-essential vote for this has to do with the fact that for the series to go out like this, it's such a shame that they didn't get a proper send-off, and it's like, come on now. I mean, this is your last episode, really? And it's really a shame that they got the shaft like that. It would have been nice if they could have had one more proper episode to end this season, but at least the animated series came after, so.
Well, you briefly alluded to what makes me love this episode so much, and that is the Shatner moments peppered all through this. I think this is one of my favorite Shatner performances of all the Star Trek episodes in the original series. I absolutely love it, and some of it's a little over the top, but man, I love watching it. I just get such a kick out, especially the court martial scene. It's so great. Absolutely love it.
I do want to hit on something that Chris mentioned about what a disappointing last episode of the series this is, and I definitely agree with him there. But I'm also almost kind of glad that the series was sort of or the rug was sort of pulled out from under the series before they had the chance to do a final episode, because how exactly would they have done it? Mm-hmm. And how much would it have changed what we got in the future in terms of the animated series or the movies? And I almost wonder, I'm really not that aware of how they wrapped series up back in the 60s. I don't think I've watched many last episodes from 60s TV shows, but I can't think of an ideal final episode for the original series.
Yeah, you know what, Craig, as much as I would love to theorize and look back and think that they would have given it a proper ending if they were actually allowed to do the two final episodes of the season instead of the network cutting the season short in the middle of filming this one. You know, they said they're going to exercise their contractual right to cut the last two episodes. Judging by the rest of the series, look at the first two seasons. They didn't have season-ending cliffhangers back then. It wasn't like you wrapped up a season and you started a season. It was just episodes. You know, in fact, a lot of the times they were not shown in the order they were produced anyway. So I think if they'd have done two more episodes, they would have just been that, regular episodes. So it will forever be the quantum leap effect, where, you know, you don't know exactly what it would have been had they been able to continue and take the stories out to their natural endings.
Yeah, I think if they would have done an actual last episode, I don't really think it would have been like, oh yeah, this is our last episode and let's like make it the last episode. I think it would have been just pretty much your basic solid Trek story, and maybe you would have got some kind of line at the end by Kirk, like maybe just reciting the spoken word part in the beginning credits, and that's it.
And you would have at least had Uhura. Yeah.
The full cast, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, big send-off. But Matt Walsky considers this an essential episode, so it's 3-1, Chris. Matt thinks it's essential for two reasons. One is the final episode, the last live-action Trek for 10 years, and it's Shatner at his most entertaining, in Matt's opinion. Low-key at first, but the signs are there. He builds up slowly, especially when he's buffing his nails. He points out the acting in the court-martial scene. Is it good acting? He doesn't know, but is it entertaining? It totally is. He likes to compare this to the angry acting in The Enemy Within, where he was split into the evil Kirk. So, and you see the difference in Shatner's technique in just 3 years. So, Spock conversing with Kirk in Lester's body is good. It's a good scene, and that was the and he points out the mention of the previous episodes. So this is one of the few instances in Star Trek, the original series, where they make mention to prior episodes in the series, which is kind of cool. And then he mentions the Chekhov and Sulu rebelling moments, which we used as part of our essential voting for this. So we see that Sulu is willing to incite a mutiny or be part of a mutiny because he doesn't believe that Kirk should be, you know, sentencing people to death. So he's willing to, you know, throw away his career and his duties in order to stand up for what he believes is right. So pretty cool. Some good moments there from Matt. Any thoughts on Matt's input, you guys?
No, just again, Matt always puts some great thought behind his notes that he send us, and I always appreciate listening to them.
Yeah, Chris, any thoughts on that?
Just agree what Craig said. Yeah, a lot of good points in there.
So that brings us to the close of part two of our season three wrap up. So this, I guess, this will give a moment to go around the table and give our final thoughts on the third season. Why don't we start with you, Craig Cohen?
Yeah, I think I kind of hit on a lot of what I wanted to say on part one. And sadly, I probably should have kept it for the second part. But I really think that the third season, I think it might get beat up a little bit more than it should. And as I said on the first part of this season wrap up, is what makes Star Trek great is the fact that we have a third season with the episodes that it has. And Star Trek was always great at being able to tell different kinds of stories. And some of the stories in season three are different, as much as quite a few of them are very similar to stories we've heard.
Yeah. Chris Ritzer, your final thoughts on the third season of the original series?
Yeah, pound for pound, I mean, it's pretty much right there with the first two seasons. I mean, it's not quite as good, but there's still some pretty decent episodes in there. I mean, not nearly as many essential episodes, because you've already had the introductions of a lot of the alien races and all that, and technology. But there's still a lot of good, solid track. You're not up to the other seasons, but it's still very good and definitely worth watching. And you don't really want to skip too much in there.
Good points. I can't really say much more than what you guys have already said. So I remember, you know, thinking that the third season was, you know, was a quote unquote the bad season. But I think looking back on it with the critical eye and looking for those essential moments like we did in this show made me appreciate, you know, some of these episodes a lot more than I used to appreciate them. So I think, you know, going through this exercise with you, Craig, has really helped expand my universe as far as Star Trek, the original series is concerned. And another thing that, and we've mentioned this before, and I'm sure everybody out there is sick and tired of hearing us talk about this, but one other thing that really contributed a lot to my love for the third season this time around was reading some of the entries from Mark Cushman's third book in the These Are the Voyages series about the making of these third season episodes. And some of the things that you thought about these episodes are really untrue. And, you know, reading the book and all of the information he was able to bring to light about the making of these episodes made me appreciate a lot of them a hell of a lot more. And we tried really hard not to spoil any of his book in our commentaries. I know we threw out a few things, but you know, if you're really interested in it, definitely pick up the third book and read about it. The third season is so fascinating. There's so much great back and forth and memos and things to read in there that, you know, the struggles with the actors themselves and scripts, it's fantastic to read. So I'm not going to add too much more to what you guys already said, but, you know, Craig, it's been a great journey with you recording all of these episodes, and this is almost a kind of a bittersweet moment knowing that we're wrapping the third season wrap up.
Yeah. And I don't know, are we going to reveal our hand now or not about what we're going to do before we get to the series wrap up?
I don't know. I don't know if we want to we want to tip the hand yet. I maybe want it to be a surprise. Yeah. I know a couple of our listeners already know what's coming up next week, but I think we have a very, very cool special treat lined up.
I say we keep it at that, and I do want to echo your sentiments right back to you, Jeff. This has really been a ton of fun. This 79 episode journey has just been greater than I could have imagined it would be, and so much fun. And you know, it really changed me as a Star Trek fan. It almost, as we've talked about it, I know it definitely bonded me closer to Star Trek. And I think we did some work here that we should really, really be proud of. And we had some great guest commentators along the way that really helped us, including Chris, who offered such great perspective at times, especially during those supplemental episodes that we did, which I think were really, really great ideas.
Yeah, absolutely, Chris. Yeah, thank you for being a recurring guest and an expert that we've been able to turn to in a lot of our supplemental episodes. And I hope that you will continue this journey with us into the future as we do the animated series and comics and beyond.
Oh, yes, certainly. Yeah, thanks a lot for having me on. It's been a blast. And yeah, I've definitely learned a lot of new things from all the episodes, listening to your commentary tracks, a lot of things I haven't considered before you guys brought up. So it was an educational experience.
I'll tell you this, Chris, I am imagining an alternate universe where you and Jeff Ferry are doing the DS9 podcast every week.
Yeah, I actually just started a rewatch of that. And yeah, almost done with the first season.
Jeff Ferry and Chris Ritzer. Jeff, if you're listening, I think you guys should start that up. I would listen to that.
Oh, totally. I'd be there for day one.
Absolutely. So, you know, Chris, you hook up with Jeff Ferry, our co-host from Slycast, and you guys line that up for us.
Alrighty.
So I guess before we close out, I guess Craig and I will make one announcement to our listeners out there who may be attending the Trek convention in Vegas. We have officially booked our airfare, and we will be at the 2015 Star Trek convention in Las Vegas in August.
Very exciting. Yeah, from I think the date of this recording, it's 55 days until day one of the convention, and we're getting there, of course, the night before, and we will be there through end of day Sunday, so we will be there the entire time.
Yes, and we're looking forward to seeing some of you again. It was great to meet some of you last time, and we're pretty excited to see everybody again, and I'm pretty excited about this, and I think it's a bit of a different feeling this time around than it was last year, because last year was our first time going there. So I feel like this year we have no set agenda, so we're going to be a lot more free to roam around. And
Yeah, I think we're not. I think now we can consider ourselves old veterans of the Vegas convention after last year, and like you said, we're not going to be as tied to things as we might have been, and we're definitely going to have a lot more time to explore. It's funny. I was thinking how cool it would be if we could actually wait to do our series wrap up until after the convention and just get as many people on the floor discussions as we could. But it's just too far out for us to put a hold on things.
Yeah, it is. Maybe someday Chris Richard will go to the convention with us.
Yes, who knows? Maybe I'll go this year still.
Oh, yeah. Well, next year's the 50th, and that is gonna. They're going all out for that one. So
that might be the year to go.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, thank you everybody out there for listening to the show. As always, it's always a pleasure to hear from you on Facebook / the Tricorder Transmissions, TTT_pod on Twitter. And our own website, thetricordertransmissions.com. And if you're going to go to the convention this year, jump on our Facebook page or the Twitter and let us know you're going. We'd love to meet up with you. We're going to be taking a lot more time, I think, this year to do fan interviews, Star Trek fan interviews out there on the floor of the convention. So we didn't get as much time to do that last year as we wanted to. So I think this year we're going to do a heck of a lot more than that. Mm-hmm. And we're also planning to do some live broadcasts from the show floor with some of our guests who are going to be there. So fantastic stuff. So thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll see you again next week.